from deep inside your radio.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. Today on the broadcast, another episode of Dick Cheney Confidential. Our first, and probably not last, Fog Watch. And an interview, well, we have our own military analyst, plus some special guests, and a special trip inside the Los Angeles sports arena to watch 8,000 people become new American citizens. Yes, your host was there. All that coming up on this edition of Le Show. And it will probably be broadcast. Stay tuned. But right now, yes, the format's different. That was an opportunity for some stations to go away and broadcast news. Yeah, I know. A news insert in the middle of this broadcast is like inviting a Chevy dealer to do the first 3 minutes of car talk. But, ladies and gentlemen, in the meantime, for you who stuck with us, let me read the trades for you. From PR Weekly, White House prepares to feed 24-hour news cycle. I'll read it for you. The eruption of war in Iraq last week set in motion a massive global PR network cultivated by the Bush administration during the month-long buildup of forces. Month-long, excuse me. The network is intended not only to disseminate, but also to dominate news of the conflict around the world. Before the attacks began, Susie DeFrancis, Deputy Assistant to President Bush for Communications, outlined the daily media relations handoff that was about to begin. When Americans wake up in the morning, they will first hear from the Persian Gulf region, maybe from General Tommy Frank, she said. Then later in the day, they'll hear from the Pentagon, then the State Department. Then later on, the White House will brief. Before anyone goes on air, however, White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer sets the day's message with an early morning conference call. While an obvious benefit to having communicators spread across time zones is the ability to dominate the 24-hour news cycle, DeFrancis said the White House would enforce clear jurisdictions between departments. For example, this being a military conflict, operational questions will be handled from the Pentagon, she said. Each night, U.S. embassies around the world, along with all federal departments in the District of Columbia, will receive a global messenger email containing talking points and ready-to-use quotes. Dominate the news cycle, ladies and gentlemen. From PR Week, ladies and gentlemen. You know what I did. I read the trades for you. It's a copyrighted feature. Rarely heard this early in the broadcast, but what are you going to do? Stay tuned. This is Le Show, and I am reading the trades for you, ladies and gentlemen. This from Shot Business, a magazine for the shooting, hunting, and outdoor trade, the official publication of the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Selling to a woman, selling guns they're talking about, is far different from selling to a man. Here are some tips on how to get and keep a woman's business. It's an issue, says Gila Hayes, contributing editor to Women and Guns magazine. Often, Hayes says, women who come into a gun store for the first time have been involved in some terrifying event. Wouldn't it be more comforting for that person to walk into the store and see someone like her? A woman clerk? Asks Hayes. There are other gender-specific issues. For example, women have far fewer holster options than men. Holsters specifically designed to fit the male anatomy are grossly inappropriate for a woman's anatomy. Telling a woman looking at such a holster to get used to it is no way to make a sale or build customer loyalty. I hope we've all gotten past the little guns for the little ladies mentality. Says the author. From Shot Business, ladies and gentlemen. Not Show Business, Shot Business magazine. Yeah. Who knew until I read the trades for you? It is a copyrighted feature. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to, I guess, the first broadcast of Le Show that many of you have heard since the war began. Last week's broadcast was preempted and screwed up and 8 Ways to Sunrise. That's why there's harryshearer.com. You can always, no matter what your local, God bless your local station, but no matter what your local station does, the broadcast is always available at harryshearer.com. And if, because I was kind of proud, kind of busting my buttons over last week's show, if you actually would like to hear what you missed and you don't have access to, now play fair, you don't have access to a computer, you can't get harryshearer.com. Only on that condition, ladies and gentlemen. You can write to Le Show Goes to War at care of KCRW, 1900 PICO Boulevard, Santa Monica, California, 90405, and we'll send you a free CD of last week's broadcast. Only if you don't have a computer or can't figure out how to work the internet or something like some dumb excuse like that, okay? Some excuse you think I'll believe. There's so much to share with you. Again, this will be a broadcast so light on music that those of you who usually write in and say, less music, will be requesting your favorite song. But that's neither here nor there. There will be many special features on today's broadcast, as I suggested in the tease. But let's get right to the interesting stuff, shall we? First of all, in the Man Bites Dog department, and I haven't heard this story anywhere else, possibly because it comes from Agence France Presse, which means, yes, they are French. Dateline Central Iraq. Iraqi civilians fleeing heavy fighting have stunned and delighted hungry U.S. Marines in Central Iraq by giving them food as guerrilla attacks continue to disrupt coalition supply lines to the rear. Excuse me. Sergeant Kenneth Wilson said Arabic-speaking U.S. troops made contact with two busloads of Iraqis fleeing south along Route 7 towards Rafit, one of the first friendly meetings with local people for the Marines around here. Quote, they had slaughtered lambs and chickens and boiled eggs and potatoes for their journey out of the front lines, Wilson said. At one camp, the buses stopped and women passed out food to the troops, who have had to ration their Army-issue packets of ready-to-eat meals due to disruptions to supply lines by fierce fighting further south. That's right. Iraqi civilians feed hungry U.S. troops. If that's not man bites dog, ladies and gentlemen, I'll bite a dog. Last week on this broadcast, we brought you up to date on the Coalition of the Willing. Well, one of the main two willing. Earlier this week, when the White House announced its $75 billion budget request to finance the war in Iraq, it included the tiny former Yugoslav Republic of Slovenia in the list of countries in line to share $5 billion in grants to help offset the cost of backing the war. No, we're not paying them to support it, but it's offsets. Slovenia, a country of fewer than 2 million people, has protested and said it didn't want Washington's offer of $4.5 million. Prime Minister Anton Rapp called a news conference to announce it was all a big mistake. Quote, when we asked for an explanation, the State Department told us we were named in the document by mistake, as we are not a member of the coalition against Iraq. We are part of no such coalition, Mr. Rapp said. We are a part of a coalition for peace. I don't think, said a leading Slovenian journalist, I don't think the State Department usually makes mistakes. Welcome. Welcome to the new thing, ladies and gentlemen, or Mr. Rop. Mr. Rop said he supported continued action through the UN and blamed his foreign minister for signing the pro-U.S. Vilnius statement on the coalition. He also denied that Slovenia was part of the coalition of the willing sending troops and supplies to Iraq. We are not on any list. We are not on the list of those who wanted to be on the list and be made public, or on the list of those who did not want to be made public. The foreign minister also backtracked, saying he really supported France and Germany's position. U.S. officials say it is just a misunderstanding, although they will not admit to having made a mistake. So, if you're keeping track, if you're keeping score on the Coalition of the Willing, tick off Slovenia, will you? Yes, there are talking points from the White House daily. The ones from the early part of the war called for regular liberation updates and an unrelenting emphasis on the voices of freedom. At first, it seemed as if these hopes might be realized. But by the seventh day, networks were carrying pictures of Iraqis surrounding the humanitarian aid trucks. It was not the storyline envisaged by the commanders of the Bush administration message machine when they began planning Operation Iraqi Freedom with the same meticulous attention to detail displayed by their military counterparts. In the next few days, the public relations emphasis has switched from Iraq's imminent liberation to denunciations of Hussein's brutality, which was making it impossible for Iraqis to express their true feelings. So that is the current talking point. Of course, the Iraqis are brutal. I believe we knew that going in, but we'll more about that, more about what we knew and didn't know. But first, here's what we need to know now. Jay Garner, the retired U.S. general who will oversee humanitarian relief and reconstruction in post-war Iraq, this is according to a London newspaper, The Observer, is president of an arms company that provides crucial technical support to missile systems vital to the U.S. invasion of the country. Garner's business background, is causing serious concerns at the United Nations and among aid agencies who are already opposed to the U.S. administration of Iraq if it comes outside U.N. authority. Well, what do you mean if? Excuse me, right here. Colin Powell, Wednesday, Washington. The United States will not cede control of Iraq to the United Nations if and when it overthrows President Saddam Hussein. Quote, we didn't take on this huge burden with our coalition partners not to be able to have a significant dominating, there's that word again, control over how it unfolds in the future. We would not support essentially handing everything over to the UN for someone designated by the UN to suddenly become in charge of this whole operation. Anyway, the United Nations and aid agency critics say the appointment of an American link to the arms trade is, quote, the worst-case scenario for running the country after the war. Garner is president of Virginia-based S.Y. Coleman, a subsidiary of Defense Electronic Group L3 Communications, which provides technical services and advice on the Patriot missile system being used in Iraq. It has also worked on the Arrow missile defense system deployed in Israel and is involved in the U.S. National Missile Defense Program, called by critics Star Wars. Jack Tyler, an S.Y. Coleman senior vice president, confirmed that Garner will held his position at the company now. But of course, when he takes, controls Iraq. I have been among the people who've noticed, if you watch the Pentagon press briefings, ladies and gentlemen, well, here's what's going on. First of all, you're noticing that criticisms are erupting of the war plan, not just of the tactics, but of the plan itself. And some people at the Pentagon and some defenders of the administration are blaming journalists. Now, I have, believe me, ladies and gentlemen, hand up, raise. I have no love for journalists, but that they're not sitting around making this stuff up. They're not sitting around. Well, some of them may be. Some of them who fancy themselves armchair generals may be. But basically, the stories we're reading are leaks from pissed off generals, ticked off high military officials who didn't get their way. Now, you know, you don't have to take sides to understand that. Donald Rumsfeld is on one side. Some of them are on the other. They're leaking. Some of them by name. For example, William Wallace. I believe that's his name. We'll check it. We'll check on that. Yeah. General William Wallace. The plan is to be decisive, rapid, lethal, and to give our adversary no edge he can take advantage of. Wallace is commander of the U.S. ground battle in Iraq. That was his quote earlier this month. After a week of war, Wallace upset the White House this week by saying publicly that Pentagon strategists had misunderstood the combativeness of Iraqi fighters. The miscalculation, he said, had stalled the coalition's drive toward Baghdad. The enemy we're fighting against is different from the one we'd wargamed against. We knew they were here, but we did not know how they would fight. Ari Fleischer said he wouldn't say whether he agreed or disagreed with Wallace. But this reminds me, ladies and gentlemen, of statements made by, I believe, Condoleezza Rice after 9/11. Nobody could have imagined anybody would do this, fly planes, civilian planes, into buildings. And, of course, then in the months afterward, we've been keeping track of the number of people who did imagine that, many of them in the United States government. Think of it. All right, so Wallace, General Wallace says, this is not what we wargamed against. In fact, however, according to story, I think read on this broadcast way back last August, militia fighters did play a crucial role in a major war game designed to simulate combat in Iraq. But the Pentagon officials who managed the game simply disregarded or overruled the militia's most devastating moves. The war game, Millennium Challenge 02, took place over 3 weeks last July and August at a cost of $250 million. Officially, the war game was a great success, but as the game was winding to a close, a retired three-star U.S. Marine Corps General, Paul Van Riper, wrote an email to some of his friends, casting grave doubt on the conclusion. Van Riper, who was running the opposition team, said the game's managers remanded some of his moves as improper and simply blocked others from being carried out. Exercise officials denied him the opportunity to use his own tactics and ideas, and on several occasions directed him not to use certain weapon systems against the U.S. forces. It even ordered him to reveal the location of U.S. forces. That's according to the Army Times. Finally, he quit the game in protest so as not to be associated with what would be misleading results. The Army Times quoted some game managers who disputed his version of events. However, it also quoted a retired colonel who was familiar with the game and supportive of the theories being questioned. I don't have a problem with the ideas, the colonel said. I do have a problem with the fact that we're trying to suggest somehow that we validated them, and now it's time to pay for them. Finally, the paper quoted a retired Army officer who has played in several war games with Van Riper. What he's done is he's made himself an expert in playing the opposition, and he's real obnoxious about it, the officer said. He will insist on being able to play as freely as possible and as imaginatively and creatively within the bounds of the framework of the game and the technology horizons and all that as possible. He can be a real pain in the ass, but that's good. He's doing all those things for the right reasons. Anyway, back to the Pentagon briefing and Tori Clark, the Victoria Clark, the chief Pentagon briefer. She's an assistant secretary of defense. And like me, you may have noticed her dependence on the color pink in many different combinations and in plaids and in checks and in blocks in her briefing wear, her briefing raiment. She stands next to General Myers, who's in uniform, and she's in pink. And it looks interesting. The Washington Post observed this as well and quoted a senior Defense Department official offering this explanation. She's colorblind. This is a quote. She couldn't tell you the exact color of what she's wearing. There's no metaphor there. It's just, that's just what it is, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, what do you say a copyrighted feature right about now? I think it's time, don't you, for the apologies of the week?
We're so sorry.
Let's start at the top. The British government apologized for any offense given to the grieving families of British soldiers killed in Iraq, but stood by Tony Blair's disputed claim that at least two of them may well have been executed after capture. Downing Street reinforced the Prime Minister's suggestion that Sapper Luke Alsop and Staff Sergeant Simon Cullingsworth were shot in cold blood after a vehicle ambush. The Armed Forces Minister, Adam Ingram, told reporters that ministers were sorry if any offense had been caused. Given the information available to us, it did indicate that these two soldiers may have been executed. If there is hurt from the language used, then we regret that. It was never intended. The Sapper's family continued to insist that Mr. Blair's claim of execution had been expressly denied by the soldier's army superiors. His stepfather says, "Both I and Luke's sister Nina are disgusted by the claims he was executed. There's no way that happened. The only way he would have been killed is in action." That's what his colonel and sergeant told us. Sapper Alsop's sister Nina has claimed the regiment's colonel called at their home to set the record straight. The colonel from his barracks came around to our house to tell us he was not executed. Luke's Land Rover was ambushed and he died instantly. A Dominican priest and a Catholic, this is another apology from down under, a Dominican priest and a Catholic worker who poured their blood on the floor of the United States Consulate General in Auckland, New Zealand, have rejected an apology given on their behalf. The Catholic Bishop of Auckland apologized for a bloody cross that was drawn on Consul General Douglas Berry's carpet in protest against the U.S.-led war in Iraq. Bishop Patrick Dunn described the gesture as offensive and abuse of hospitality. He offered an apology on behalf of the city's Catholics and asked to be sent the bill for cleaning the carpet. However, Father Peter Murnane and fellow protester Nicholas Drake, who had concealed their blood in containers they took into the consulate, have declined the apology. Father Murnane said Bishop Dunn missed the point of their actions, which was designed to shock. I see, shock without awe. That's a new one. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean has sent a handwritten letter to Democratic presidential primary rival John Edwards, apologizing for saying that Edwards avoided talking about his support of the Iraqi conflict before a largely anti-war audience. During a speech to California Democrats earlier this month, Dean criticized Edwards for backing the war. He said Edwards and John Kerry, who voted last fall for a congressional resolution authorizing force, did not stand by their positions when they addressed that group. But Edwards, who spoke before Dean addressed the California audience, had pledged support for disarming Iraq by force and was booed and jeered by many in the crowd. Dean said he had not heard Edwards' speech and was unaware of what the North Carolina had said when he criticized him. "I thought it did take a lot of guts for him to get up in front of the convention and say what he did, and I commend him for that," Dean said Wednesday. He said he mailed a personal letter of apology to Edwards during a campaign stop in Iowa. And WNYE New York apologizes to the listeners of this broadcast due to operator error. The wrong program was played last week. Thank you for that, ladies and gentlemen. The apologies of the week. Now, in answer to, this is off topic A, because you got to get off topic A every once in a while. The discussion we've been having here about why flu is seasonal, whether flu is seasonal, whether it's just our imaginations, what happens down under. This is the first indication that there is a flu season down under, like there should be. Dateline Australia. Australians have been warned that three potentially deadly strains of influenza are about to hit the continent. Of course, it is coming on to wintertime there. Health Minister Kay Patterson said expert influenza observers were predicting a bad flu season in Australia. The World Health Organization's Influenza Research Center in Melbourne has warned that three potentially fatal strains of influenza were likely to hit Australia this winter, and they predicted this year could be a very bad flu season, Patterson said. Alan Hampson of the WHO Research Center said the A Panama flu is by far the most dangerous. The three strains of virus had all been seen in the Northern Hemisphere last winter. That is to say, the winter we've just had up here. So, do they get ours after we get them? We get them from China? Is this the deal? We get them from China. Then we sent him to Australia. I'm just trying to figure this out, ladies and gentlemen, because you got to know. Could we have known on the subject of, did anybody know that this was the way the war, aside from the war game? Intelligence analysts warned senior Pentagon officials before the war in Iraq began that Iraq paramilitary units would fight back and could pose a significant threat to American-led coalition forces. This is the CIA covering its hiney to the New York Times. Central Intelligence Agency issued a report last month, all the way last month, that said paramilitary units loyal to Saddam Hussein could threaten rear areas during an Allied advance. The agency report also raised concerns about the possibility that the paramilitary forces could mount attacks against Iraqi civilians and use other irregular methods, blah, blah, blah. So, don't blame the CIA, ladies and gentlemen. They just want you to know that, because you pay for them. From his weblog, called a blog, conservative commentator Andrew Sullivan wrote this week, quote, "It seems to me we may have underestimated the psychological effect of President George H.W. Bush's brutal betrayal of the Iraqi people in 1991 at the behest of the UN. I also think we hawks might have underestimated the Iraqi sense of national violation at being invaded, despite their hatred of Saddam." Unquote. And finally, at the top of this broadcast, our first fog watch, you know, the fog of war does weird things. I think it was Monday or Tuesday of this week, Fox News Channel. Stop it. Stop it, ladies and gentlemen. Listen to me now. Fox News Channel reported in a headline top story of the hour that a major civilian uprising in the southern Iraqi city of Basra is now underway. This is an uprising that had long been expected, and it now appears to be underway. That was a report on the Fox News Channel. And watching that, I thought, well, doggone it. You know, if they're right, this is a major scoop, because neither MSNBC nor CNN was reporting it. But a couple hours later, they chimed in. Still, major scoop for Fox. The source turned out to be British intelligence. 3 or 4 days went by. No confirmation, no unconfirmation. The first reporter from Reuters into Basra on Thursday or Friday, told the BBC there were no signs of a civilian uprising. In Sunday's London Telegraph, a conservative newspaper that supports the war, has another reporter who claims to be the first into Basra. She writes, "As I travel 4 miles or so inside the city, which after a tense 10-day standoff with coalition forces is still being held by Iraqis loyal to Saddam, young men look sullen and angry, few speak English, but one is face streaked with dust and dirt, holds up a fist, brandishing it above his head. The young man's eyes smolder with hatred. Enemy is all he can say in English." According to Russian intelligence, rumors about an uprising in Basra by the Shiite population turned out to be false. Moreover, the Shiite community leaders called on the local residents to fight, quote, the children of Satan, i.e., the Americans and the British. Fog Watch, ladies and gentlemen. Episode 1.
If blood will flow, when flesh and steel are one, drying in the color of the evening sun, perhaps the rain will wash the tears away. Something in our minds will always say, perhaps this final act was meant to quench your lifetime's argument, that
nothing comes from violence, and nothing ever could. For all those born beneath that angry star, lest we forget how fragile we are. Flesh and steel are one, shrine in the color of the evening sun. Perhaps the rain will wash the tears away. Something in our minds alone will serve. Perhaps this final act was meant to quench a lifetime's argument. That nothing comes from violence, and nothing ever could. For all those born beneath that angry star, lest we forget how fragile we are.
We're really throwing out the format wheel type clock on this week's edition of the show. Not that we ever had one, but we are throwing it out this week because in addition to the news cutaway that some stations availed themselves of, we have our own military consultant in the studio as of this week, General Rusty Scabbard, who is the retired commander of the 3rd U.S. Is that battalion or brigade?
It's battalion. A lot of my subordinates have always told me that, General Scabbard, your handwriting is bad enough. You could be a doctor.
General, mm-hmm. Let's go to the map, the war map, mm-hmm. on the floor here in the Show Dome, and maybe you could walk us through the hot spots at this hour.
All right. I'm standing on the map.
As we speak. Okay.
This is El Najarif, mm-hmm. which is a key choke point on the road to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
On the west bank of the Euphrates River, or the River Euphrates, as it's denominated here.
Okay, well, that's a Canadian map.
Roger that. So you've got potentially the 3rd Infantry Division of the 7th Army.
The 3rd.
Along this line here, which I'm going to just walk along this line, there's supposed to be an electronic sound.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. It's the audio telestrator mm-hmm. people did that.
We worked on that.
We're not hearing that. All right, General, just walk along it and tell us what else we'll find.
All right. Yes, sir.
Okay.
To the direct left of me, approximately 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock.
You would find then, under ideal conditions, mm-hmm. the 77th. Motorized
77th
battalion
mm-hmm.
from the third,
the
75th airborne force,
75th,
the so-called spotted cats.
Oh yes,
which would be Marine Aviation.
Mm-hmm.
The 4th Infantry Division,
the 4th
of the 1st Army.
Yeah,
which rarely is.
No, I was going to say that
is deployed.
Yeah.
And elements of the 4th and 7th.
4th
and
7th.
Now, right against that, yep. you have
over at 6 o'clock.
15th
uh-huh.
Motorized Battalion 15th. Of the Iraqi Regular Army.
Right.
And the 6th Regular Army
okay.
Battalion.
Yeah.
So you do the math on that, 17 and 6. You're basically, it's the equivalent of fighting the 23rd.
Gotcha. So
now, we've depicted resistance, the resistance of the Iraqi forces
mm-hmm.
in three-dimensional relief here, so you can get some
feel for it. Yeah. What?
I believe I stepped on the elite Republican Guards. But the point remains the same.
Yes, it does, and we will get the elite Republican Guards fixed for next hour. Thank you, General. On our newsmaker line now, things are happening so fast today. From New York, recently with CNN and now currently not with CNN, but veteran newscaster, news anchor, news host Connie Chung. I am amazed and surprised that you made time to be with us on the show today.
Well, Larry King was booked. I do have to say,
yeah.
I'm amazed that the general was walking on a floor map on the radio.
When I came in today, but I don't read the memos, so... Connie, mm-hmm. you were let go by CNN this week, and I understand there was some negotiation with Fox Television, but instead you have an announcement today.
Well, no television journalist could ever quite resist the temptation to work for Fox.
Mm.
They are, in a way, the gold standard of modern television journalism.
Modern,
but
yeah.
Sometimes there's something more valuable than gold. And Continental Public Radio offered me my own broadcast mm-hmm. nightly.
Wow.
But it's not Connie Chung tonight. It's a very different broadcast. We don't mm-hmm. even call it a show.
Well, right there.
Mm-hmm.
So, Connie, what is it? It'll be, I guess, heard on public radio stations around the country.
That's right.
What exactly is the program about?
It's called Beneath the Lines.
Okay.
And basically, it's my own version of we cover the media, which is the biggest story.
Yeah.
Obviously, in this war, the media is the biggest story around.
It is number
And we're covering mm-hmm. the story of the media. Many shows have done it once a week.
That's
Nobody's
right.
ever done it on a nightly basis.
Every
and
night.
And that's what my mandate is.
Okay.
You know, this is such a different show from the show that they made me do at CNN. And if I'd been allowed to do this, I think I'd still be at CNN. But there's no place I'd rather be than Continental Public Radio because they're letting me do this show.
Which is a broadcast. Connie,
right.
What would... I'm sure you've worked out a typical kind of or a prototype kind of...
We've done many.
Hour of the broadcast.
Yes. If we were on this week, we have a feature with Scott Peterson, the husband of Lacey Peterson, who is missing. And we would ask him, we have it on tape, as a matter of fact, how he feels suddenly being out of the media.
Wow.
Which is a totally new experience for him
since the case began. Yeah.
And yet the case is going on. So there's an interesting tension there. And then we would analyze the coverage of the Dixie Chicks case and how that's affected all of our lives. And the Dixie Chicks.
The Natalie Maines criticized the president. And
That's right.
Would you have Natalie Maines or one of the Dixie Chicks on the broadcast?
It's an analytical program.
Okay.
We'd only have celebrities on if they wanted to analyze themselves.
I think many of them might. Connie Chung, host of a new public radio broadcast on Continental Public Radio, Beneath the Lines. We'll be looking forward to that nightly. And General Rusty Scabbard earlier in this segment. And whatever is happening, it will happen next here on Le Show. So, ladies and gentlemen, you probably saw on television or heard on radio this week the story of the huge en masse swearing-in of new American citizens at the Los Angeles Sports Arena. I think 8,000 people swore in on Friday at the former home of the Clippers. That's more people than went to a Clipper game the entire time the Clippers were playing at the Sports Arena. So they should have had citizenship night there. We'll give away a free citizenship and a bobblehead doll of the president. That would be the way to get people to Clipper games. Anyway, for no money, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, too, people showed up to do this. I was in attendance because a member of my family is a new American citizen as of Friday morning, and I was there to witness it. And my favorite, just a couple of things. The guy who announces what you got to do and what you got to not do before the judge comes in to swear people in. And so his warm-up guy announces that, ladies and gentlemen, for today's purposes, this is the largest federal district court in America. Nobody cheers. See, if that was New York, they would have cheered that. So he says, we ask you to observe courtroom etiquette. Now, courtroom etiquette means sitting quietly with your hands in your lap and not talking. A minute later, he says, now, after the judge has sworn you in, please express your emotions, wave your flags, and cheer. So courtroom etiquette, except after you're sworn in when, you know, they want to take pictures of people being happy. The first two videos shown to these people after they became new citizens, their first new video sightings as citizens in the sports arena, a welcome from President George W. Bush and a 20-year-old video of God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood. In all fairness, music played on the audio system while they were filing in included Blowing in the Wind. You probably know this, ladies and gentlemen. Halliburton Company is not among the finalists for a $600 million government contract to help rebuild Iraq. The Houston-based engineering, construction, and oil field service giant has been culled from a short list of companies bidding to repair Iraq's roads, bridges, and schools. After the war, the federal government had solicited bids from five U.S. firms for the contract. Reports that Halliburton was on the list for a major role in war reconstruction had created a political uproar since Vice President Dick Cheney once ran the company. It remained unclear Friday whether Halliburton had submitted a bid. While it will not work as the prime contractor, Halliburton could still do significant work as a subcontractor, according to U.S. aid officials. Of course, earlier this week, Richard Perle resigned as chairman of the Defense Policy Board, an unpaid advisory position, after a similar political uproar over his connections to Global Crossing, a currently bankrupt U.S. communications firm which is attempting to get sold to financiers with Chinese ties. They're lovely ties. You've seen them. They have the butterfly on them. Anyway, rather than let that controversy simmer. Pearl resigned, snapping at a New York Times reporter who called him for comment. If I was going to talk to anybody, you'd be the last person I was going to talk to. Pearl has also threatened to sue Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker in a British court and has called Hersh a terrorist on television. Not that Hersh is a terrorist on television. On television, Pearl has called Hersh a terrorist. Anyway, this is, I guess, the Halliburton news is maybe bad news for Dick Cheney. There's only one way to find out.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who's less than a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney, confidential. 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 Call me a cockeyed optimist or just a hopeless romantic. But this is the time of year when hope is in bloom in Washington. Oh, sure, some people just see the explosion, you should pardon expression, of cherry blossoms as a pathetic payoff by a humiliated, defeated enemy to the capital city of its conquering ruler. But for me, looking up at them through video feeds in a secure, undisclosed location, they bring a message of hope, especially in a time of challenge. Oh, sure, the Navy was trying to screw us by only providing cable TV to the secure undisclosed location instead of premium satellite television, as per the agreement, but Lynn was dealing with that, and that gave me hope. She's always been a tough negotiator. See our prenup for details. But while Don Rumsfeld was dealing with the collateral damage of an easy war he helped make hard, I was trying to put out a more sophisticated fire. Friday, March 28th, I'd finally gotten through to the CEO, my constituent in chief. But I wasn't sure I was really getting through. 10:48 a.m.
See, here's what puts the savage red skin inside of me on the warpath. Mm-hmm. You know, they're saying, Mr. President, we told you there might be resistance. Mm-hmm. It's right there in the fine print.
Yeah.
I mean, shoot, Cheney, if I wanted to sit around and read fine print, I'd go back to running the Rangers.
Yes, sir. I'm glad I was able to get a few minutes with you. Obviously, security dictates that we have to talk telephonically.
Well, that's the other thing I don't understand. Mm-hmm. You know, you're sitting in the Roosevelt room in the White House. I'm right next...
I don't think we have to discuss operational details in this line, sir. What I did think we might have to discuss is Texas.
Texas? Mm-hmm. Oh, don't get me started. Jeepers, H. Cripes. You don't think I'd rather be rolling a state senator from Appaloosa with a $2 handshake and a $10 wink than having to deal with this basket of snakes right about now? I mean, hey, look, nobody wants to micromanage less than I do. That contradicts every inborn instinct I picked up in biz school. But if choosing individual targets in wartime was good enough for another Texan president by the name of Johnson...
Mr. President hates to not make the best use of my few hours above ground.
Oh, sure.
And I do happen to think that we're starting to let our critics make us act as if we're ashamed of our purposes and our friends, especially our Texas friends.
Oh, now listen, Dick, I know what this is about. Mm-hmm. You're afraid, as am I, that Port of Houston's going to lose that grant as we go through the budgeting process. Well, we're on that.
Sir, you're talking about minnows. I'm talking about marlin.
Mm-hmm. Bigger fish.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Halliburton's going to have to win this contract on the merits. I think the mere suspicion of favoritism, given my longtime association with the company, could be a totally unnecessary distraction. So, yes, they have to submit the best bid. They can do that. They know how to write a winning bid.
Oh, I know they do, but I just got to protect you and me from being Dick Pearled on any of this stuff.
Well,
don't want to get Dick Pearled.
Uh-huh.
It's too bad even Dick Pearl is getting Dick Pearled, but...
Sir, I don't say this as your vice president.
Okay.
Or as a former president of the company, or even as a voter in the great state of Wyoming.
Okay.
I say this as a Texan. Don't mess with me on this.
You know, it's funny. I was just telling Dad, that was our first mistake, Operation Iraqi Freedom. I mean, it's a good name. I know it tested well, but... The name of the campaign should have been Operation Don't Mess with Texas. I mean, everybody understands that.
Well, I'm not saying I wouldn't have wanted to be a fly on the wall during that conversation, but getting back to our conversation.
Dick, telling our friends down at Halliburton to have a little patience, that would seem to fall within your vice presidential duties.
Mm-hmm. Well, sir, pardon my curiosity. It helps to cover my wounded pride, but can I ask how much patience?
About $2 billion worth. You tell Lynn I say good luck with the Navy.
I can't blame the constituent in chief for using me as an errand boy to counsel patience among our friends in the corporate community. I mean, after all, it's the same thing I told Dick Pearl when I Dick Pearled him. End of partial diary for March 28th. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential.
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 So, ladies and gentlemen, broadcast news consultants have been advising news and talk stations across the nation to wave the flag and downplay protest against the war, according to the Washington Post. Quote, get the following production pieces in the studio now. Patriotic music that makes you cry, salute, get cold chills, go for the emotion. That's according to McVeigh Media, a Cleveland-based consultant, in a war manual memo to its station clients. Air the national anthem at a specified time each day as long as the USA is at war, unquote. The company, which describes itself as the largest radio consultant in the world, also has been counseling talk show stations to, quote, make sure your hosts aren't over the top. Polarizing discussions are shaky ground. This is not the time to take cheap shots to get reaction, not when our young men and women are in harm's way. Well, that's almost reasonable. The influential television news consulting firm Frank Maggot and Associates put it in starker terms. Covering war protests may be harmful to a station's bottom line. In a survey released last week on the eve of war, the firm found that war protests were the topic that tested lowest among 6,400 viewers across the nation. Maggot said only 14% of respondents said TV news wasn't paying enough attention to anti-war demonstrations and peace activities. Just 13% thought that in the event of war, the news should pay more attention to dissent. Maggot, whose representatives did not return phone calls, offers no direct advice about what stations should do. However, the research's implied message might be obvious. McVeigh's suggestions for covering the war include dispatch reporters to military bases in your area. Are your local reserve or guard units involved? Do they have veterans of the Gulf War still at home? It also advised clients to find experts in some 30 categories, veterans of Desert Storm, former G-men, military recruiting offices, most of whom would be unlikely to be critics of the war. Have at least one expert outside the broadcast industry as your go-to analyst, the company said, adding, a former military specialist is ideal. Hey, I guess I lucked in with General Scabbard. I think there's just political correctness to waving the flag right now, said Holland Cook, a McVeigh News Talk specialist. If you were the upstart station in town, you might conceivably come at this from a peacenik angle by going on the air with the body count, by pointing out we haven't got Osama bin Laden or Saddam yet, by saying we should end the madness. But we find it appropriate to wave the flag where I happen to be advising clients, he said. Some of the orientation reflects opinion polls that show upward of 70% of Americans favor the war. That means, as one local media executive put it, almost everyone wants to be seen as pro-military, if not necessarily pro-war. If one of our guys got on the air and started ranting against the war, it would create an unnecessary controversy. As a business, you don't want half the population hating you, so you plant your flag in the sand. Sand, ladies and gentlemen, doesn't sound like a very stable place to plant your flag, but, you know. Dateline Munich, the man who constructed Saddam Hussein's underground bunker beneath the Baghdad Palace, says it will take 16 Tomahawk cruise missiles landing one after the other on exactly the same spot to penetrate the steel and concrete labyrinth. Builder Carl Essner from Munich has been watching the war in Iraq and says the Iraqi dictator is 100% safe in the bunker Esser created. He takes pride in his building being able to defy all but the heaviest of coalition attacks. 20 years ago, he was asked by Austrian architect Lorenzo Buffalo.
I'm reading this. I'm not making it up. To head the construction team of the Dusseldorf company, Busfau and Nauer, in constructing the underground hiding place. The companies that built the bunker have since been absorbed by larger groups in Germany. Esser said, I built atom bomb-proof bunkers and was then asked to work on the bunker in Iraq. It was an interest I inherited from my grandmother, who built many bunkers for the Third Reich and was heavily involved in the Hitler bunker in Berlin. Granny Anna was a much-respected and very busy bunker builder in those times. Ladies and gentlemen, I understand this program was preempted on some stations last week, but other programs were not, and now I know why.
This week on This Iraqi Life, the bare necessities.
I never thought I'd miss water so much. I mean, you know, it's just water, right?
So I get through the checkpoints, and I get through the shooting, and I get to the video shop, and all they've got left is two Tom Cruise videos. I mean, talk about a bad day.
Getting by without a little help from your friends. This week on This Iraqi Life, from Continental Public Radio, radio that makes you sound interesting.
And finally, ladies and gentlemen, this week, in the earliest years of the Cold War, before the Soviet Union exploded its first atomic bomb, there were calls in the United States for preventive war. The calls continued even after the Soviets detonated their first bomb in 1949. In 1950, the commandant of the Air Force's new Air War College publicly asked to be given the order to conduct a nuclear strike against fledgling Soviet atomic capabilities. And when I went to Christ, said the commandant, I think I could explain to him why I wanted to do it now before it's too late. I think I could explain to him that I had saved civilization. With the A-bomb used in time, we can immobilize a foe and reduce his crime before it happened. Unquote. The commandant was fired by President Truman. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time. Over God knows how many of these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, if it's not preempted there, on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, if it's not preempted there, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, if it's not preempted there, on shortwave, WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz, if it's not preempted there, on Sirius satellite radio all across North America, if it's not preempted there, and never preempted, on your computer at two different locations, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And it would be just like not being preempted if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. The LeBlast newsletter is actually up and running, and the email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.